They call it sibling rivalry, and it's the stuff of drama. From Cain and Abel to Succession, great novels, family sagas, enduring TV series, powerful movies, all gathered around the themes of rivalry and struggle between brothers or sometimes sisters. The tense human drama of complex and sometimes tortured personalities locked in fierce emotional battles for control of the family fortune or the love of a special woman or man. Sibling rivalry. Jacob and Esau are Bible classic icons of sibling rivalry, their struggles and tussles no less compelling than those of the Logan family in New York City or the brothers Mitchell down at the Royal Vic. So we tune in to the story of Jacob and Esau, a colourful, passionate tale of human weakness, ingenuity and ruthlessness. The Bible is nowhere more brilliant in a purely literary sense. The test of great writing is whether or not it can, with economy and accuracy, express the profound characteristics of the individual. In half a page, the souls of Jacob and Esau are laid bare, and with a brilliant clarity and discipline, the writer tells us all we need to know about these terrible twins. A few deft strokes of his pen, a couple of pieces of revealing dialogue, and the two men are opened up in a profound way. Quite brilliant storytelling. For we learn that although the boys were brought up in the same house, under the same influences, they end up being about as different as calcium and camembert. One of the great mysteries and miracles of family life is that within it, in spite of it, the sacred secret of individual personality is demonstrated and preserved. For although the schools and the parents and the holidays and the TV programs watched and the friends shared may be the same, the children, the brothers and sisters, still find room to develop and express individuality, one of the most precious of God's gifts. Despite what the dogmatists of sociology may say, putting it all down to upbringing, the spirit of personality is never quite snuffed out. A farmer has six sons. One becomes Scotland's national poet. Five don't. A man has two sons. One becomes a successful businessman. The other is Dr. David Livingstone. So the boys grow up in different directions. Esau, the man of action, the kind of guy who kicks sand in your face, taut, hard-muscled, a keen eye, a hunter, a he-man. Jacob, the runt of the litter, having just clung to life and no more, intellectual, clever, a thinker, a planner, a schemer, one who watched and waited. Jacob, summed up by the prophet Hosea as, "In the womb he took his brother by the heel, and in his manhood he strove with God." Quite a CV. The emotional dynamite in the situation was the harsh reality that Isaac, their father, was not content to let each be himself, express his own character, make his own unique and valued contribution. Oh no, Isaac had his favourite, and his favourite was Esau. Esau, strong and virile. He was a real man doing macho things. And of course, as the elder brother, in him resided the destiny of the dynasty, the destiny of God's people. The old man smiled. The God of Abram, Isaac, and Esau. Yes, that had a certain ring to it, a pleasing sound. Ah, but Jacob, on the other hand, weedy, dark-eyed little Jacob, well, he was a problem. Isaac worried about the boy, spending rather too much time with the woman, a bit of a mummy's boy. A real disappointment, to be honest. Why could he not be more like Esau, a man's man, out hunting the deer from which Isaac's favourite venison hot pot could be made? Well, Jacob was nobody's fool. He saw, he knew how his father felt. He knew he was not okay, while big Esau, big, hearty, hairy Esau, one of the lads, a bit of a jock, was most certainly not okay. He was very okay. So Jacob came scurrying to his mother for all the support his fragile ego needed. What a recipe for drama in all this cross-current of hurt, disappointment and ambition. Get that movie script written. The weak-willed, indulgent father, the brash, confident elder son, the younger brother, hurt and angry, the mother running her fingers soothingly through his dark curls. There, there, it's all right, my pet. One day you'll come out on top. You'll see, Jacob. The differences between the boys and the whole tapestry of the unfolding drama is cleverly summed up in the names they had. Esau, Esau meaning the covered one, the hairy one, the red one, or he who drinks the red lentil broth. Jacob, the name means he who overreaches, the one who gets above himself, the tenacious one, who will not let go until he gets what he wants. Jacob, his character full of wiles, compromises and deceits, yet who somehow sees more clearly than Esau the true value of things. Like the birthright which he purchased from Esau for the now legendary mess of pottage, a phrase that's gone down in literature as a powerful description of someone giving up something precious for something short-term and cheap. To sell your birthright for a mess of pottage, a proverbial warning against swapping something important, enduring, cherished, for something shallow, unworthy, and temporary. To give up something valuable for a momentary gratification. History is full of examples of that. So what was it about this famous birthright that led Jacob to his deceits and wheel of dealing? Well, in purely cash terms, Esau really miscalculated badly, paid a high price for his bowl of soup, because the possessor of the birthright was eligible for a double share of the father's estate. So this was probably the most expensive bowl of soup in history, for Isaac was a rich man. But for Jacob, it was the fact that the possessor of the birthright became head of the household. That was the real key, the real motivation behind all his Machiavellian scheming. For to the legitimate possessor of the birthright fell the heritage of the nation. It would be the God of Abram, Isaac, and wait for it, yes, Jacob. And it would be his name, not that of Esau, that would march into history. Suck on those lemons, big brother. The historical identity of the people of God would be forever indissolubly linked with dark-eyed little Jacob, and who would kick sand in his face then? The promise of God that had come to Abraham and had been confirmed in Isaac would come to him now, heir to the promise of God's special favour. Now, that was surely worth something. So why on earth did Esau do it? Throw it all away, so that he came to weep bitterly over the whole affair. Regrets he had a few. Had his reasoning faculties been so undermined by his hard day in the broiling sun? Or was he, as the writer to the Hebrews suggests, a profane man who despised his birthright? For he, as the Genesis chronicler makes clear, he is the one who must carry the can. It's not Jacob who's rebuked for his greed and opportunism, but Esau for his abrogation of responsibility, his shoddy, appetite-driven choice, his, get this, neglect of the holy. In Esau's harsh declaration, "What use is it to me, this birthright?" we see summed up what is increasingly the attitude of Western culture and civilization. We don't say, "What a beautiful waterfall," and enjoy it for what it is. We say, "What use is this? This could be used to generate electricity." We don't say, "What a lovely, secluded, unspoilt sea loch." We say, "What use is this? We could turn this into a harbour for shipping in the oil-related industries, or we could repair our nuclear submarines here in the deep waters of the loch. What an amazing treasure house of Alaskan wildlife and nature and this vast empty loveliness." No, we say, "What use is this? What can we find here that we can dig up and monetize?" Things and people tend to be catalogued according to their usefulness or not. And disturbingly, their usefulness in the short-term, immediate sense, so that people come to assess their own worth in terms of their usefulness. The old lady who looks eagerly for death because "I'm no use to anyone anymore" is echoing the mistake of Esau. And our cultural preoccupations aggravate the error. For Esau missed something crucial and precious. He failed to appreciate that there is a whole realm of values that can't simply be added up and calculated and a usefulness label attached to them. What use is a rose? What use is listening to a beautiful piece of music or enjoying a lovely painting? What use is a sunset or a love song or a hug or a hand clasp? When we begin to allow ourselves to think in the reductionist categories of pure pragmatism or mere usefulness, we tumble headlong into Esau's error, his big mistake. The old lady is not useful in any narrowly economic sense, but she is who she is. She is herself, and her value lies not in her contribution towards the financial or industrial or economic strength of the nation, but because she is herself, that unique person whose being with us will never be repeated, though the world should stand forever. She is that unique person whose being with us will never be repeated, though the world should stand forever. So look at her. Understand and appreciate that there has never been, nor will there ever be, in all time, anyone else who is that unique individual. Frail, fragile, vulnerable. A sacred blessing. When we begin to stroll around the world with our pocket calculator in our hand, we're doomed. For we're blinded from a true and proper Christian evaluation of individuals, of what really counts. Nonsense. A nice bowl of soup in the hand is worth any amount of pie in the sky to a hungry man, says Esau. And lets slip his birthright. Notional birthrights in the future are too vague, too far in the distance. Give me something in my hand, here and now, in my moment of physical appetite and longing, something I can touch and drink down now. That's what I call reality, Jacob. The here and now, the moment. You can have all the future birthrights you want, all the abstract futures you care to consider. This lentil soup, this red lentil broth, is real, and it tastes so good. I know what I want, what I really, really want. I want it, and I want it now. And Jacob leans against the wall, arms folded, and watches this big hairy ape slipping down the stuff, and he can barely suppress a whoop of triumph. For he has pulled off a real scoop. Someday soon, Esau will rue his mistake. Will appreciate with a bitter regret that he's been short-sighted. He's looked only superficially on things. He has made the fatal assumption that because from time to time it may look that way, it may seem that man does live by bread alone, in fact there's more to it than that, more to us than that, much more. Jacob prefers to invest in the unseen values, the seemingly useless things of sentiment, meaning, spiritual values. And with all the coolness of a superb safe breaker, he pulls off this audacious burglary of the spiritual jewels of a generation. He knows that the value systems of the marketplace hold no sway in the kingdom of God, that neither a person nor a set of values is to be assessed by their apparent usefulness or not. He knows instinctively that in spite of appearances, man does not live by bread alone and never will, but by those truths and values that are intangible, invisible, and eternal, that are rooted at the very core of our being, represent the very heartbeat of the cosmos. Truths that are sometimes tragically easy to forget, truths we sometimes fail to acknowledge, are crucial to our wholeness and our humanity. What's the use of worshipping God? What's the use of visiting the very ill relative who doesn't even seem to know we're there at all? What's the use of praying? What's the use of making sacrifices? What's the use of love? The wise person looks not on the surface, merely at the category of usefulness. They look rather to the heart of the matter, and they ask, what does this mean? What does this mean? When we put that question to our existence, we go a long way towards a proper respect for it, and we begin to find the possibility of understanding it. Understanding it and those precious people with whom we share the journey.